off, Jack's dad tells him. I know it's hard to listen to him freaking out so much lately since his meds were changed. I'm sorry our basketball game was interrupted, but your mom needed my help with Todd. You deserve better. But you know, Jack, for now we all just have to be good to each other and be patient. Todd can't help his problems. Your mom and I are doing the best we can. It'll get better. And finally, here's what goes on in Zeke's household. Zeke comes in through the kitchen, and the screen door slams. He enters the house with dread, because he knows he'll have to show his mom the note from his teacher. Zeke feels awful, because here is another burden for his mother to have to deal with, when she's already dealing with so much. Quickly, Zeke's mother appears from another part of the house, her finger pressed to her lips. "Shh, Zeke, your father is asleep. He had a rough night last night." At first, Zeke feels a giant wave of relief. He had hoped that his father would be asleep, so that he'd only have to deal with his mother's reaction to the note. But the relief is quickly replaced by shame. "My father is sick, and all I care about is myself. I'm a bad person." When a child grows up with a serious illness in the family, whether it's that of a parent or of a sibling, the caregiving that would normally go toward the child is compromised. Tom, Jack, and Zeke don't have the freedom to be themselves. Notice that Zeke feels guilty for having normal events and feelings, having a note sent home, and hoping to avoid trouble for it. Often, the caregiver parent is stretched thin herself and calls upon the well child, implicitly or explicitly, to selflessly help out. Life in a household with an ill child or parent is often in crisis mode. For example, while a parent makes frequent trips to the hospital, the emotionally neglected child heats a frozen dinner and eats alone in front of the TV. Or the child finds himself constantly catching bits of medical conversations he wasn't supposed to hear and doesn't understand. The child gets rides with someone else's parents to soccer games. He gets used to his parents being irritated by him for little reason. Parents of ill households usually recognize that there is an impact on the healthy child. They may check in with him, attempt to discuss how he's doing, and offer what support they can. They are conscious of the amount of time spent on the ill family member, and even worry about it. So these parents seem like the last parents who would emotionally neglect their healthy children. But multiple studies have examined the perceptions of both the parents and the healthy child in a household where someone is ill. In these studies, the parents and the healthy child are asked to rate how the healthy child is doing. Results consistently show that parents see their healthy child as doing okay, while that same child perceives him or herself in a much more negative light. Conclusions: when parents are, or feel, powerless to change the bad things in their children's lives, they tend to minimize the effects of those bad things. Not only do such parents subconsciously minimize their child's distress, they also inadvertently burden him with a maturity of which he is not really capable. They often need and expect their healthy child to be as compassionate, as selfless, and as patient as they themselves need to be. Sometimes, family illnesses impact an entire childhood. In such cases, the child is likely to develop quasi-adult behaviors that don't fall apart until adolescence. Stuart. Stuart's father and mother bring him to therapy because, they say, at age 15 he has become so negative. Initially, he is almost silent for several meetings, resenting that he has been forced to come here and refusing to say much. I see immediately that Stuart's parents are consumed by concern for Stuart's older brother, Larry, who has a disease that makes him extremely vulnerable to infections. I see this because, while attempting to take Stuart's developmental history in the parent interview, Stuart's parents keep drifting back to the subject of Larry, and are seemingly unaware of doing it. From that, I know that Stuart, like many siblings of ill children, has held in his negative emotions and his own needs for years. It seems clear to me that Stuart has finally reached his breaking point. His facade is crumbling, and he can no longer be okay. The breakdown of Stuart's stoic attitude is inevitable, but mysterious to his parents. They wonder where their helpful, nice son is gone, and they've brought him to therapy to fix his negative attitude. After a few meetings alone with me, Stuart begins to talk. He explains to me that he doesn't bring friends home because he feels guilty that he can have normal friendships while Larry cannot. And he's also wary that his friends might not understand some of Larry's quirky behaviors. And then he feels guilty for being embarrassed by his brother, whom he loves. So here he is, in my office, feeling guilty for causing his parents more problems, starved for attention, resentful that they can't recognize his sorrow, and unable to put any of it into words. When, after a few meetings, Stuart has an incident at home in which he gets verbally angry with them, his parents tell me that therapy is making Stuart worse. I encourage Stuart to respond, and he blurts out, "Everything is always about Larry. You even left my All-Star game early to pick up his medications." His parents start to protest, saying they left just a few minutes early and that he's being overly sensitive. At this point, I intervene firmly. This is exactly the problem. Stuart isn't really allowed to say how he feels, and when he does, you call him sensitive. Larry is not the only child who needs help, but your good intentions for helping Larry are interfering with your ability to parent Stuart. You're making him feel guilty for having needs and feelings. This difficult moment in my office was a turning point for Stuart. Luckily, these parents were ultimately able to understand how Larry's illness had stunted Stuart's social and emotional growth for quite some time, causing him to hold in guilt, anger, and sadness. Although they brought Stuart to therapy in hopes that he would change, it turned out that their change was as dramatic as Stuart's, if not more so. The reason they had failed to notice Stuart struggling was that he'd given them no trouble growing up. Stuart's parents finally realized that that's what they'd been expecting from him throughout his brother's illness, no trouble. With this awareness, Stuart's parents began to pay more attention to his needs and feelings. If they are able to continue that throughout Stuart's adolescence, the effects of emotional neglect can be reversed, and Stuart can grow up to be happy and healthy. Type 9. The Achievement or Perfection-Focused Parent. The achievement or perfection-focused parent seldom seems to be satisfied. If his child comes home with straight A's, he will say, "Next time I'll expect A pluses." This parent has a few things in common with the narcissistic parent we talked about. In fact, many of his behaviors are similar. A lot of narcissistic parents are perfection-focused because they want their child to reflect well on them. In other words, if my child makes straight A's, it makes me look really good. This mirror effect is some part of most achievement or perfection parents. We'll call them AP parents for short. But it's not always. AP parents can be motivated by a number of different factors. Not all AP parents are emotionally neglectful. Many parents of Olympic athletes, concert pianists, and professional baseball players could be considered AP because they are driven and they support their child to be the best. But the difference between a non-neglectful AP parent and a neglectful one is this: support. A healthy AP parent is supporting her child to achieve what the child wants. An unhealthy AP parent is pressuring her child to achieve what the parent wants. Some AP parents pressure their children to achieve because they desperately want opportunities for their children that they themselves did not have. Many are acting out of their own feeling that they themselves must be perfect. Some are trying to live their own life through their child. Still other AP parents may be simply raising their child the way they themselves were raised because it's what they know. When young Zeke hands the note to his AP mom, what do you think she would say? Zeke. Zeke, how could you behave this way at school? Now Mrs. Rollo may change your mind about writing the recommendation letter to help with your application to the Superior Amazing Child School. We need to call Mrs. Rollo right now and smooth this over. Or, AP Mom number 2, Zeke, you know better than to balance a pencil on your finger, point side up. Mrs. Rollo is right. If you poked yourself in the eye, it could slow down your progress on the piano. How can you practice if you can't see the music? Or AP Mom number 3. Zeke, I'm terribly disappointed in you. I've made so many sacrifices so that you can be at this expensive school. If Mrs. Rollo starts to see you as a problem child, you may ruin everything I've done for you. You have to think about your future. Notice that all three of these reactions seem to have Zeke's best interests in mind. These AP mothers are clearly concerned about their child and want the best for him. The problem is that all three mothers are emotionally neglecting Zeke with their responses. None of these responses addresses Zeke's need to learn to control his impulses. None addresses Zeke's recent feelings of being treated like a baby by his siblings. None of these responses talks to Zeke about anything that matters to him. All of the responses address the parents' needs, not Zeke's. They address Zeke's future, which he is too young to care about or even understand. They take away an opportunity for Zeke to learn something about himself, his nature, his feelings, and how to get along with authority figures. Over time, in order to take in the simplistic message, "Be good so that you can be successful," Zeke will have to squelch many of his own needs and feelings. This may work fine in childhood, but he will enter adolescence and adulthood with something missing inside: self-knowledge, emotional awareness, and self-love. Tim. Tim was literally dragged to couples therapy by his wife, Trish. In our first appointment, it was hard to get Tim to say much at all. The one thing he expressed when he did talk was that he was disappointed in himself and Trish. We love each other, and that should be enough. But nothing's ever enough for Trish, he said. When I asked him to elaborate, he would only say, I can't see why she won't just let things go. Why can't she just be happy? If I had taken this at face value, I might have been thinking at that point that Trish must be somewhat difficult to get along with. But having worked with many couples, I could see that there was definitely a lot more to the story. As I asked Trish questions, she started to cry. Here's what she told me about her reasons for bringing Tim to therapy. Tim says he's happy in our marriage, but he doesn't seem happy. He comes home from work irritable. He's a wonderful father, but sometimes he snaps at the kids when they behave any way other than perfect. He's always down on himself. He's a VP at his company at only 40 years old, but he still feels inadequate because he thinks he should be CEO by now. When I try to talk to him, he shuts me down. I know he's miserable, and I want to help, but I can't. At this point, I love him, but I can't live this way anymore. Please help us so that we can stay together. Let's pause here for a moment and consider Tim. Already, in the first 15 minutes of our first session, I strongly suspected that he was emotionally neglected as a child. Here were the emotional neglect signs that I could see in him. When you hear Chapter 3, you'll learn much more about these signs. Irritability, perfectionism, evidenced by his lack of tolerance for his kids' mistakes. Lack of emotional awareness, evidenced by, why can't she just be happy? Counter-dependence, evidenced by feeling disappointed in himself for needing help, and by his refusal to accept help from Trish. Lack of compassion for himself, evidenced by Trish's report that Tim feels inadequate for being VP instead of CEO. After half a dozen couples meetings, Tim was finally willing to have some individual sessions. In those meetings, I discovered that Tim's parents, while loving, raised him with one primary goal: to be successful. His stresses, struggles, achievements, and abilities in childhood were all seen through the lens of the future by his parents. Tim had learned well that his feelings, needs, and experiences were not relevant to anything. All that mattered was, what does this mean for your future? Tim entered adulthood, married, and had his own children with very little knowledge about himself, his emotions, or how to connect with people, including his wife. Fortunately, since Tim was able to open up and share all of this with me, we were able to address it. After a number of individual sessions, he was able to apply his newfound self-acceptance, compassion, and tolerance to his marriage and children. When a child is treated by her AP parents as if her feelings and emotional needs don't matter, a deeply personal part of herself is being denied. That part of her becomes like the elephant in the room. No one wants to see or hear from it, yet it's the part of her which is most her. The only way that most of these children can adapt, get along, and grow in the family is to participate in the denial and pretend that their emotional self doesn't exist. No wonder neglected children grow up with an empty space in their sense of themselves, their love for themselves, and their ability to emotionally connect to others. Type 10. The sociopathic parent. This will likely be the most surprising parent type that I will talk about in this book. Even if you are 100% certain that this category doesn't apply to you, I recommend that you listen to this section. Who comes to your mind when you hear the word sociopath? Hannibal Lecter? Tony Soprano? Mussolini? These are indeed iconic representations of the concept, but they are the most extreme, dramatic, and obvious versions of sociopathy. The kind of sociopath we're interested in is different. This sociopath quite possibly never breaks a law and has never been to jail, is far less obvious but far more commonplace. This sociopath might be your neighbor, your brother, your mother, or your father. She or he can hide behind a perfect manicure, an excellent job, charity work, or the PTA. Most people would not ever think of this person as a sociopath. In fact, she may have a charisma that draws people to her. She may be admired and appear selfless and kind to many. But deep down, she is not like the rest of us. Sometimes no one can see that something is wrong except the people who are closest to her. Often her children can feel it, but that doesn't mean they understand it. There is one main feature that sets sociopaths apart from the rest of us. That one thing can be expressed in one word: conscience. Simply put, a sociopath feels no guilt. Because of this, he's freed up to do virtually anything without having to pay any internal price for it. A sociopath can say or do anything she wants and not feel bad the next day or ever. Along with a lack of guilt comes a profound lack of empathy. For the sociopath, other people's feelings are meaningless because she has no ability to feel them. In fact, sociopaths don't really feel anything the way the rest of us do. Their emotions operate under a very different system, which revolves around controlling others. If the sociopath succeeds in controlling you, he may actually feel some love for you. The flip side of that coin is that if he fails at controlling you, he will despise you. He uses underhanded means to get his way, and if that doesn't work, he'll bully. If that fails, he'll retaliate by trying to hurt you. Having no conscience frees up the sociopath to use any underhanded means to get her way. She can be verbally ruthless. She can portray things falsely. She can twist others' words to her own purposes. She can blame others when things go awry. It's not necessary to own her mistakes, because it's much easier to blame someone else. The sociopath has discovered the value of playing the victim, and plays it like a virtuoso. According to Dr. Martha Stout, who wrote The Sociopath Next Door, the single most reliable indicator that you're dealing with a sociopath is when a person appears to purposely hurt you and then proceeds normally as if they did nothing wrong, and as if you should not be hurt. If someone does that to you repeatedly, you should consider the possibility that you're dealing with a sociopath. When the person is one of your parents, this realization can be incredibly painful, but also freeing and life-changing. Typically, the children of sociopaths desperately try to make sense of their parents' behavior. They can be very creative in trying to explain the unexplainable. Here are a few of the many excuses I've heard the adult children of sociopaths come up with to try to make sense of their parents' hurtful, underhanded, or ruthless behaviors. He has anxiety. She doesn't really mean it. Something's wrong with her brain. He just cares too much. She can't help it. He had a difficult childhood. To better understand what these adult children are trying to explain away, let's check in again with Zeke, right after he hands his sociopathic mother the note. Zeke watches his mother read the note. As he does so, he sees her lips compress in a thin, hard line of displeasure. "What? How could you do this, Zeke? I'm so embarrassed that you would behave this way at school." Zeke's eyes begin to brim with tears. "He starts to say. His mother interrupts him. "Not a word from you. I don't want you to speak or even look at me. Go to your room right now and write, 'I will never get in trouble at school again,' 50 times. And it had better be in cursive, and it had better be readable. I don't want to see your face until you're done, and that means no dinner for you." After spending 4 hours in his room, writing and crying and crying and writing, Zeke manages to write the sentence only 20 times, and none of them in cursive. He feels cold terror in his heart because he knows his mother will be enraged when she sees he printed. There's no help for this, however, because he's far from mastering cursive writing at his age, having only just been introduced to it at school. But he's hungry and sad and feels desperately guilty that he's angered his mother so. He draws a heart on the bottom of the paper for his mother and gingerly ventures from his room to where his mom is watching TV. "Mom, I can only do 20. I promise I won't get in trouble again. Can I please stop?" he says meekly. Zeke's mother doesn't take her eyes off the TV, so she doesn't see his mussed hair, exhaustion, or tear-streaked face. "Get back in your room now," she growls, "or I'll give you something to really cry about. And for coming out of there before I said, you can write it 10 extra times." She stands menacingly and starts walking toward Zeke. Zeke knows it's time to retreat. He runs to his room, falls on his bed, and cries himself to sleep. Notice that in this interaction, Zeke's mother has exhibited an extreme lack of familiarity with her own child. She's unaware of what he can and can't do developmentally, whether or not he can write that much or in cursive, and of his feelings, empathy. She's also shown an extreme and unhealthy need to wield power over him, control. Also, she's shown cruelty and a willingness to hurt her son emotionally that borders on sadism, taking enjoyment in hurting others. While extreme and harsh punishments are a hallmark of sociopathy, not all sociopathic parents necessarily mete out extreme consequences. Some give no punishments and exercise their need to control in other ways, through the use of guilt or behind-the-scenes manipulation, for example. The common factor for all sociopathic parents is that to them, raising a child is much like everything else. It's all about power and control. Wallace. 47-year-old Wallace came to therapy after the death of his elderly father, not because he wanted help with grief, but because of his extreme burden of guilt in his relationship with his mother. Wallace lives 2 hours away from his parents, yet for the last 2 decades he's visited them only once per year, or even less. When I explored this with him, it became clear that as long as he could remember, he's felt guilty about this. He told me that he felt like a most uncaring and unappreciative son for not visiting his parents enough. Yet he reported that almost every time he visits them, he gets either depressed or physically ill. It makes me not want to go there. Also, my wife really hates to visit, probably because my mom dislikes her. Wallace described his recently deceased father as a workaholic who was not around much or very involved in his life. He described his mother as a difficult person. When I asked Wallace questions about this, he explained, "Nothing I can do has ever been enough for her. She resents my wife, and I think it's mostly because she feels that my wife took my attention away from her." Wallace explained that his mother feels that he is a selfish man for visiting so little, and she tells him so, directly or indirectly, every time they talk or see each other. Over the years, she has expressed her disappointment in his lack of devotion to her via various means. He told me one story which, in a nutshell, shows his mother's sociopathic style. One Christmas, Wallace and his wife and kids decided to bite the bullet and succumb to his mother's wishes. They hadn't visited his parents for almost a year, and knew that they needed to put in an appearance at the Christmas dinner his mother was putting together. Wallace's mother was delighted that he was coming, even making the sweet potato recipe that was his childhood favorite. The visit seemed to be going remarkably well, until it was time to open gifts. As the grandchildren excitedly tore into the brightly wrapped packages to see what their grandparents had given them, Wallace's heart sank. He realized that his mother had again expressed her disappointment in his lack of attentiveness to her. This time, she had made her point by giving her other grandchildren expensive new iPods, and Wallace's children cheap plastic toy cameras. Wallace's children expressed polite thanks to their grandparents, but Walter could tell that they were mystified and hurt by the dramatic gap between their gifts and the gifts that their cousins received. Later that day, when he had an opportunity to speak privately with his kids, Wallace tried to explain to them the inequality of the gifts. He told them that their grandparents were elderly and didn't realize how different the gifts were, but he felt that this was one incident that he couldn't let go. He knew that he had to confront his mother about it. He found her alone in the kitchen and asked her if the gifts were a way of trying to tell him something. "Is Christmas to you only about how expensive the gifts are, Wallace? You've never cared about anything but money. Next year I'll be sure to spend more on your children, if that makes you happy." Then she added, "I guess that's what I should expect from someone too busy to visit his own parents." That evening, at Christmas dinner, Wallace's mother acted as though nothing negative had happened. She behaved as if Christmas was merry, as if everything was fine, and appeared to expect Wallace to do the same. In this one story from his adult life, she has exhibited all of the traits of a sociopath: trying to control him via underhanded means, viciously attacking him and then acting as if the attack hadn't happened, painting herself as the victim, neglected mother, and blaming Wallace, selfish son. In addition, she was willing to hurt her grandchildren in order to hurt her son. As Wallace and I worked together over time, he was able to see that the guilt he was taking on was misplaced. His mother, and by not intervening, his father, had driven him away with these kinds of controlling, punishing behaviors throughout his childhood adolescence, and adulthood. He was getting depressed and sick during visits because he didn't understand what was happening. He was swallowing his mother's toxins because he had grown up with them and couldn't see them for what they were, partially blaming himself instead. Recognizing his mother as a sociopath helped him understand that he needed to protect himself and his children in whatever way was necessary. He was then freed up to focus on that instead of on his misplaced guilt. Type 11. Child as parent. This type of parent actually allows, encourages, or forces his child to behave as if he is a parent, not a child. Sometimes the child must parent himself, and sometimes he must parent his siblings, too. In the most extreme examples, a child can even be called upon to parent her own parent. In the large majority of these families, there is some sort of extreme hardship which forces the child to suddenly become an adult. Some of the parenting types we've already talked about are good examples of families with such hardship. Take, for instance, the bereaved family, the family with an ill family member, or the family in which there's an addicted or depressed parent. Another example might be a family with financial difficulties such that both parents are forced to work long hours. In all of these, there's some reason why the real parent is not performing the parental functions so that the child has to step up and take them over. Zeke. Third grader Zeke walks home with the note from his teacher in his pocket. He rushes along as fast as he can because he knows that he has to get home before his 5-year-old sister gets dropped off from kindergarten by the neighbor. She's too young to be home alone, and his mother won't be back from her job cashiering at the local Stop and Shop until 8 p.m. Zeke doesn't give even a tiny bit of worry to his note. He knows that his mother won't be upset because she knows how responsible he is. She relies on him and trusts him to take care of his sister, make them both peanut butter sandwiches for dinner, and get his sister into her pajamas before she gets home from work. She won't yell or be worried. Here Zeke's lack of concern about his mother's reaction shows that he doesn't see himself in the child role. He's essentially playing an adult role with all of his responsibilities with his little sister. Also, those responsibilities give him a status in which he has more power and authority than he should have with his mother. In the absence of a parent-child boundary, Zeke stands to learn nothing from the incident at school. Zeke is essentially missing out on childhood, which puts him at risk for more rebellious behavior as an adolescent. But unless his circumstances change, he'll very likely grow up to be an overly responsible adult who has difficulty knowing what he feels, what he wants, or that either matters. This is a setup for the empty, disconnected feeling that many emotionally neglected adults experience. That said, it's very important to take note of one key thing. Being in a family that's compromised in some way, single parent, sick sibling, or financial hardship, for example, is by no means a sentence for emotional neglect. Many, many parents who are coping with challenges such as these do manage to stay attuned to their child and provide him with the care and attention he will need in order to feel connected and filled up as an adult. In fact, spending a lot of time with your child is not even a requirement for preventing emotional neglect. You can be aware of your child's feelings, help him understand himself, and stay in tune with his emotional needs without spending tremendous amounts of time with him. Time helps make it easier, but a lack of it can be overcome. To illustrate this important point, let's revisit Sally. Sally. Remember Sally, whom we talked about in the Type 4 bereaved parent? Sally's father died of cancer when she was young. This loss of her father had a profound effect on her personality and functioning as an adult. Remember that no one had told the children that their father was likely to die. Sally was told, "Daddy's gone," by her sister, not by her mother. After Sally's father died, her mother seldom spoke of him again. The children were left home alone after that point to essentially care for and parent themselves, because their mother had to work long hours in a menial job to support the family. Which aspects of this scenario do you think led to Sally's feelings of emptiness and of living in a colorless world as an adult? The death of her father? Her mother's long hours after the death? The financial hardship that followed? The answer is none of the above. All of those factors are things that happened. They're events. Events themselves don't cause emotional neglect. If Sally's mom, in the thick of her own grief, had had the ability to be emotionally attuned to the needs of her children, things could have turned out very differently. The cause of Sally's emotional neglect was not the loss of her father, nor was it what happened after her father's death. The cause was actually what didn't happen before and after her father's death. No communication from her parents about Dad's illness, no emotional preparation of the children for what was to come, Dad's protracted illness and death, no careful, gentle sharing of the news of the death, no attention from parents and other adult family members to the children's confusion, shock, and grief after the death. No allowing the children to talk and share their feelings in remembrance of their dad, or to make sense of their feelings and give each other emotional support. All of these factors are the absence of something. They're the white space in the family picture, the background rather than the foreground. That's why Sally would have so much difficulty as an adult seeing what was wrong with her and why. Type 12. The well-meaning but neglected themselves parent. Even the most loving and well-meaning parents can be emotionally neglectful. As noted at the beginning of this chapter, the WMBNT parent type probably makes up the largest subset of emotionally neglectful parents. After hearing about all of these different types of emotionally neglectful parents, you're probably developing a sense of how a loving, caring parent can be emotionally neglectful. It is entirely possible for a parent who loves and wants the best for his child to emotionally neglect her. The truth is, to love your child is a very different thing from being in tune with your child. For healthy development, loving a child just isn't enough. For a parent to be in tune with his child, he must be a person who is aware of and understands emotions in general. He must be observant so that he can see what his child can and can't do as he develops. And he must be willing and able to put in the effort and energy required to truly know his child. A well-meaning parent who lacks in any one of these areas is at risk of emotionally failing his child. To get a better idea of how WMBNT parenting works and repeats itself, let's revisit Zeke one last time. Zeke walks home from school with the note from his teacher in his pocket. His mother is in the living room watching Oprah. "Hi, Zeke, how was school?" she calls out from the other room. When he walks into the living room and nervously tries to hand her the note, she asks him to wait a minute until a commercial comes on. He stands for a moment with the note in his hand and then retreats to his bedroom to play video games. He leaves the note on his bureau. The next day, his mother finds the note when she goes to put some laundry in his drawer. As she reads the note, she is momentarily bothered, but she thinks to herself, "Wow, Mrs. Rollo sure overreacts to things," and puts the note and the problem behind her. In this example, Zeke's mom, although a loving mother, is not attending to the feeling level of life. She didn't sense whatever Zeke might have been feeling about having to hand her a note from his teacher, such as anxiety or consternation. She does not see a reason to be concerned about his disrespected school, because she's blind to the connection between behavior, feelings, and relationships. In this case, the relationship between Zeke and Mrs. Rollo. She places no value on Mrs. Rollo's feelings, considering them an overreaction. These are sure signs of a person who is not aware or in touch with the world of emotion, and who lives mostly on the surface of life. Many of the parents we've already talked about in this book could very possibly fall into this category in addition to their own type. Let's go back and take a look at all of the parents we've already discussed who may potentially be WMBNT. Sophia, Joseph, and Renee's authoritarian parents. Many authoritarian parents were raised by such parents themselves. They love their children, but authoritarian parenting is all they know. Samantha's and Eli's permissive parents had the misguided belief that it is loving to let their kids do as they wish. Sally's grieving mother loved her children and did the best she could to take care of them. She simply didn't have the emotional skills to be in touch with their feelings or help them manage them. It's likely that her parents didn't teach her those skills. Margot's depressed parents clearly loved her. They may not have realized what was missing in their parenting of Margot because they didn't receive it from their own parents. Sam's workaholic parents wanted to provide the best for him. They mistakenly thought material wealth would result in a happy, well-adjusted child. Tim's achievement or perfection-focused parents had raised him this way, and he was, in turn, raising his children this way. None of these well-meaning people probably had any idea that they were not providing their children with the fuel that they would need for a happy, connected life. They were each simply recreating what they had experienced in their own childhoods. One of the unfortunate aspects of emotional neglect is that it's self-propagating. Emotionally neglected children grow up with a blind spot about emotions, their own as well as those of others. When they become parents themselves, they're unaware of the emotions of their own children, and they raise their children to have the same blind spot, and so on, and so on, and so on. There will be more examples given in this book of well-meaning but neglected themselves parents. See if you can identify them as you continue on to Part 2. Part 2. Out of Fuel. Chapter 3. The Neglected Child All Grown Up. Think of childhood as the foundation of a house. Think of adulthood as the house. It is certainly possible to build a house with a flawed foundation, and in fact, it may look exactly the same as a well-built house. But if the foundation is cracked, crooked, or weak, it will not be an important source of strength and security. It's not a noticeable flaw, but it could place the structure of the house itself at risk. One strong wind, and it comes tumbling down. Adults who grew up emotionally neglected often seem normal on the surface, but are frequently unaware of the structural flaw in their foundation. They also have no idea that their childhood played a role. Instead, they tend to blame themselves for whatever difficulties they may be experiencing in life. Why do other people seem happier than me? Why is it easier to give than to receive? Why do I not feel closer to my loved ones? What is missing within me? You will meet many people in these pages, typically very intelligent, likable, and lovable folks who have grappled with these questions. They are far better at giving than at receiving. They tend to guard the secret of their emptiness quite carefully, so it is very difficult for anyone to notice what's missing. Only the closest people in their lives get even the slightest glimpse. Everyone's experience is different. There are 6 billion people in the world, and no two stories are the same. But when dealing with emotional neglect, I see certain common themes arising in the adults who grew up this way. In this chapter, we'll go through some of those themes. They are 1. Feelings of emptiness. 2. Counter-dependence. 3. Unrealistic self-appraisal. 4. No compassion for self, plenty for others. 5. Guilt and shame. What is wrong with me? 6. Self-directed anger, self-blame. 7. The fatal flaw. If people really know me, they won't like me. 8. Difficulty nurturing self and others. 9. Poor self-discipline. 10. Alexithymia. Poor awareness and understanding of emotions. People's reasons for experiencing these feelings are unique to their lives, but the issues are not without their common ties. You'll hear the story of Laura, whose parents didn't respond when, over the years, more than one friend committed suicide, making her believe that she shouldn't respond either. I'll also tell you about Josh, whose mother was so busy building her career that she didn't give him any feedback, positive or negative, on which to build his identity. At the end of each section, I'll list a few signs and signals to help you determine if you fit this category. But before you listen on, one caveat. As you hear the signs and signals listed, you may find yourself thinking, gee, I don't know anyone who doesn't have some of these, and you'll be right about that. Every human being has some of these characteristics and challenges. Keep in mind that I am speaking to people who have a significant struggle with these problems, and who intuitively feel, as they hear this book, that they are hearing about themselves. 1. Feelings of emptiness. Few people come to therapy because they feel empty inside. It's not a disorder in and of itself, like anxiety or depression, nor is it experienced by most people as a symptom that interferes with their lives. It's more a generic feeling of discomfort, a lack of being filled up that may come and go. Some people experience it physically, as an empty space in their belly or chest. Others experience it more as an emotional numbness. You may have a general sense that you're missing something that everybody else has, or that you're on the outside looking in. Something just isn't right, but it's hard to name. It makes you feel somehow set apart, disconnected, as if you're not enjoying life as you should. I have found that most emotionally neglected people who come to therapy for anxiety, depression, or family-related problems, for example, eventually express these empty feelings in some way. Typically, the emptiness is chronic and has ebbed and flowed over the course of their lives. It may be difficult to imagine what would make a person feel this way. The answer lies in emotional responses from parents during childhood. We'll take a look at several examples of the causes of these feelings, the ways they manifest themselves, and the processes that fix them. To begin, let's look at a general example of emptiness brought on by emotionally neglectful parents. Simon. Simon was a handsome, fit 38-year-old when he first came to treatment. His presenting problem was an inability to have a relationship, despite interest from plenty of women. Simon wanted to find out what was wrong, what was getting in his way. By all appearances, he was a wonderful catch. Successful as a stock analyst, he drove a Porsche and owned a beautiful condo in Boston. He loved to skydive and, as a hobby, restored old Porsches and raced them. Was he too particular in choosing women? Did he have a fear of commitment? It took some time in our work together for the real Simon to come out of hiding. Simon was the child of wealthy parents. He grew up in a huge house with a lot of acreage, most of it wooded. His parents traveled often, leaving him and his younger sister at home with a nanny. His sister was disabled, so she needed lots of care. When they were home from their travels, they focused the majority of their parenting energy upon her, leaving Simon to his own devices. Remembering Chapter 2, you might see that Simon's parents would fit best into a combination of two parenting types, parent of an ill sibling and permissive. Simon's parents were truly pathologically disconnected from him. He generally ran free, with no limits or rules. As a child, he spent lots of time alone in the woods. As an adolescent, he became very active in drinking and smoking pot. When he got a DUI, his father showed brief concern, but it didn't last. Simon shared a memory of often hanging out alone for hours amongst the trees behind his house as a teen, feeling restless, not wanting to go home because there was nothing for him there. He would maybe smoke a joint, delaying his return until long after dark, wanting to put off as long as possible the terrible feelings that he experienced when he walked through that door. He had intense anger toward his parents, which he couldn't understand or make sense of, mixed with an overwhelming feeling of aloneness and a desperate wish that he had a girlfriend, a constant companion to fill the vast void that was his life. After receiving some attention and concern from his father after his DUI, Simon got back on track, graduated from college, and earned his degree in economics. He moved to Los Angeles and worked for a huge firm for several years. He was very successful and made lots of money. He developed a relationship with a woman which went fine until she wanted to get married. At that point, he began to feel numb and empty and tired of Los Angeles. He abruptly broke off the relationship, quit his job, and moved to Boston. In Boston, he easily reestablished himself in a new job because he was well-educated, marketable, and able to demand a good salary. Once he had established his new life, however, he soon discovered those old feelings of restlessness coming back. Something wasn't right. He still wasn't happy. This is when he began to skydive and race Porsches. He was trying to fight off his emptiness with extreme sports. The shot of adrenaline he got each time he jumped out of a plane worked miracles, but only briefly. On his drive home from a jump, the old feelings would seep back, the numbness, the emptiness, and he would start to wish that his parachute hadn't opened. He would imagine himself dead, and what a relief that would be. In fact, he had been plagued with thoughts like this off and on for years. Simon wanted to die not because he felt too much, but because he felt nothing. He was unable to have a relationship because he was empty, incapable of giving or receiving. He moved through the world in a restless search for meaning, discarding jobs, condos, cars, and people when they failed to deliver. He wanted what everyone else seemed to find so easily, but which proved elusive to him, a connection with another human being. In therapy, my work with Simon focused on feelings. When he told stories about his life, I would often interrupt and ask, "And how did you feel right in that moment?" Or, "How do you feel right now as you talk about this?" At first, Simon was irritated by my questions. He experienced them as interruptions, irrelevant tangents taking us in the wrong direction, away from the point he was trying to make with the story. Gradually, however, over about 2 years of therapy, his mind began to open up to the world of emotion. In attempting to answer my queries, he slowly became able to turn his attention inward, focus on his inner experience, and put names to his feelings. Interestingly, as Simon became a more feeling person, he began to experience sexual problems with the woman he was dating. As he became more able to connect with his girlfriend emotionally, he became less able to have sex with her. His impotence became a source of great distress for him. The second part of his treatment, then, was helping him recognize that he was literally raised to be a lone wolf, that he had cut off his emotional self so completely in relationships that the mere concept of mixing emotional closeness and sexual intimacy terrified and threatened him. Most of us know that sex for the sake of sex is easy. Sex in the service of emotional intimacy? Well, that's a little more daunting. For Simon, When sex started to have meaning and feelings attached, it was more than he could handle. His body handled this for him by shutting down his ability to have sex. Much to Simon's credit, he persevered. He was eventually able, through hard work in therapy, to grow more comfortable within himself. 3 girlfriends later, he found a woman with whom he felt safe enough, emotionally, to enjoy true intimacy. You may be wondering about the connection between Simon's feelings of emptiness, his numbness, and his relationship problems. They are all side effects of one core issue, emotional neglect. Simon's formative years were spent alone and lonely, with very little feeling between his parents and himself. The emotional substance that allows a child to connect to his parents, people, and the world in general was absent. Simon grew up in an emotional vacuum. He tried to fill himself up with peers, pot, and parties. He sought out girlfriend after girlfriend, hoping they would fill him with meaning and connection. None of these strategies worked. In the end, it took therapy to make him look inward, not outward, for the answer. He had to learn about emotions, accept that he had emotions, and allow himself to feel them in order to experience the substance, the richness, and the meaning in life. Only then was he capable of a relationship that had substance, richness, and meaning. The fuel of life is feeling. If we're not filled up in childhood, we must fill ourselves as adults. Otherwise, we will find ourselves running on empty. Simon is, of course, a fairly extreme example of emptiness. Many neglected people have it in a much milder form and are not so tortured by it. But I have found that emptiness, at its mildest, interferes with a person's ability to engage in and enjoy life. At its most severe, it can drive people to consider, or even act on, suicide. Signs and signals of emptiness. At times, you feel physically empty inside. You are emotionally numb. You question the meaning or purpose of life. You have suicidal thoughts that seem to come out of nowhere. You are a thrill seeker. You feel mystifyingly different from other people. You often feel like you're on the outside looking in. If you feel that several of these signs describe you, it's important to consider the possibility that you were emotionally neglected. But don't despair. Once you've figured out which aspects of emotional neglect apply to you, you can correct and combat its effects. 2. Counterdependence. Everyone knows what dependence is. Webster's Dictionary defines it as determined or conditioned by another, relying on another for support. Conversely, independence can be described as not determined or conditioned by another, not needing to rely on another for support. Not many people have heard the term counterdependence. It's not a term that is in common use, and not a concept that is familiar to many people.